Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Added sugar is cloaked in everything from ketchup to salad dressing, from yogurt to pre-sliced bread. And that's why we consume way more than we realize. The American Heart Association says American adults consume an average of 77 grams of sugar per day. That's more than three times the recommended amount for women. Children consume even more. A pediatrician has collaborated with a nutritionist on a new cookbook for families looking to lower their sugar intake. The book is titled Half the Sugar, All the Love. Jennifer Tyler Lee is an award-winning author, game creator, self-trained home cook, and healthy eating advocate who earned her certificate in nutrition and healthy living from Cornell University. She co-authored Half the Sugar, All the Love with pediatrician Dr. Anisha Patel. Welcome, Jennifer Tyler Lee.
Hi, good morning. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
So what do we mean by added sugar?
Yeah, that's a great place to start. So there's a big difference between added sugar and naturally occurring sugar. And what we're most concerned about here is added sugar. Those are sugars that are added to food. So just like it sounds, table sugar, honey, agave, coconut sugar, things that are added to foods to sweeten them. The difference with naturally occurring sugar, which we're not worried about here, we want to increase fruits and vegetables, those fruits and vegetables come naturally packaged with fiber, and that fiber is the difference. It helps slow absorption in your body and make it easier for you to process, and it also helps you feel full. So I use those fiber-rich fruits and vegetables in the book to sweeten our favorite foods instead of added sugar.
You know, a lot of people are surprised, and I was back in the day when I realized that there's so much sugar, just even in ketchup. People don't think of sugar being in ketchup, right?
Yeah, hidden sugars are very sneaky, and they can surprise us, and they can show up in surprising amounts. So, for example, foods that are savory, like soups, tomato soup, for example, salad dressings, sauces, things where you don't expect sugar to be, a package of tomato soup can have as much added sugar as a packaged snack cake. So you're not really thinking about consuming added sugar when you're having soup. Same thing with a salad dressing. Some salad dressings, I pulled one off the shelf the other day, it had 12 grams of added sugar per serving, which is about as much as a glazed donut.
We're talking to Jennifer Tyler Lee. She's co-author of the new cookbook, Half the Sugar, All the Love, a Family Cookbook, 100 Easy Low Sugar Recipes for Every Meal of the Day. If you have a question for Jennifer Tyler Lee, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So when I'm making an oil and vinegar from scratch, which is no big whoop, why? I don't add sugar to it, although there are some dressings I make from scratch where I add a little bit of honey sometimes because that's what the recipe calls for. But why in simple oil and vinegar, why is there added sugar in that?
Yeah, so in some cases in a packaged oil and vinegar, you may not find much added sugar. But in other dressings like creamy poppy seed or maybe a strawberry balsamic or sometimes even ranch, you're going to see it showing up. And what I do in the book instead, there's a creamy poppy seed dressing in the book that I sweeten with pears. And it's so easy to make in your blender, right? You just throw in those pears with olive oil, Dijon mustard, a little bit of white wine vinegar, spices. That thing comes together in 2 minutes. But sugar shows up, it actually shows up in more than 70% of processed and packaged foods. And a lot of it is as a preservative, and sometimes it's also to flavor ingredients that maybe weren't as flavorful when they went into the package. So cooking is really the antidote to added sugar, and even making something as simple as a dressing will help you on your way because it allows you to regain control over what's going into your food, just some simple changes.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. You know, I remember years ago someone told me I could lower the acidity in my tomato sauce by adding carrots instead of sugar. Now, I wasn't even adding sugar at that point because I didn't understand. But is that the sort of substitutes that you're talking about, that kind of a thing?
I love that kind of a thing. So the creamy tomato soup that's in my new book, Half the Sugar, All the Love, is sweetened with carrots. And those carrots add a velvety texture without cream, and they also add natural sweetness. And that recipe, I love it because it's easy, but it also illustrates another really great point, which is if you're going to reduce added sugar, what you don't want to do is increase saturated fats and sodium to mask that change. And that's a big part of why we kind of got into this problem in the first place. Back when low fat was the trend and fat was being taken out of a lot of products, sugar went in. And that's a big part of the reason why we're seeing it in places that you wouldn't normally expect.
Salt is another problem. Sodium's another issue, right?
It is. So when we developed the recipes in the book, so my co-author on this book, Dr. Anisha Patel, is on faculty at Stanford. We had an amazing team of people working with us on this book, including a nutritionist at UC Berkeley, who helped us ensure that all of the nutritional targets were balanced. Because, again, you can't take added sugar out and then increase saturated fats and sodium to mask that change. Now, if you're having a dessert, the saturated fat might go up. If you're having a salty sauce, right, the sodium's going to go up a little bit. But we've given you a way in the book to balance those throughout the day and not exceed them by a huge number, right? So everything is mindful of those three macronutrients, the carbohydrates, the saturated fats, and sodium, so that you're not taking out one thing and getting hit with another.
Fruit juice gets a bad rap, and that's for good reason, right? Most of that stuff is pure sugar.
So juice is a really important issue to raise. It can be confusing. There are some new beverage guidelines that were really national beverage guidelines that were released in November, and Dr. Patel was on that working group that helped develop those guidelines. Juice for kids under the age of 2 is not recommended. Added sugar for kids under the age of 2 is not recommended. And then juice should be kept to a very small amount. You're thinking 4 ounces, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's a half a cup max. And the reason is when that fiber that we talked about up at the top of this segment, when the fiber is removed from the fruit, that juice can act like added sugar in your body. And there's also some different organizations count juice different ways. So the World Health Organization considers juice an added sugar. It also considers juice concentrates an added sugar. The American Heart Association considers those juice concentrates added sugar, but not juice. So it's a little bit confusing.
Mm-hmm.
It would be good to go back to those beverage guidelines, those new beverage guidelines, and review them just to make sure you're doing the right thing for your kids and keeping juice in check.
You know, one of the reasons why people use so much processed food is because it's convenient. How did you make sure? It says on the front, kid tested, doctor approved, but is it parent cook tested? Is this stuff that people can actually realistically take the time to make?
Yes. So I had a very important goal in developing the recipes in this book. First, that they were easy. So my 13-year-old at the time was testing the recipes. She tested all the recipes in the book and made them without my assistance. So if a 13-year-old can do it, you can do it. Also, they're very easy preparations. So that dressing, that creamy poppy seed dressing, takes 2 minutes in your blender and uses it, all the recipes use ingredients that are probably already in your pantry. So there's nothing fancy. I use fresh fruits and vegetables that are fiber-rich to sweeten instead of added sugar. I also will pull in things like peanut butter or spices, but nothing fancy. Probably the fanciest item in the book is a medjool date that I like to use because those add sweetness without added sugar. But it was really important to make the recipes easy and accessible, and also ones that you're commonly consuming and then remastered in a healthier way. So the way we decided which recipes to include, I did a Google Analytics analysis of what people were searching for. Banana bread, for example, comes up really high on that search. And looked at grocery store data to understand what is going through the grocery aisle, and let's take those popular items and remaster them.
Already we know if you're shopping in a grocery store or when you're shopping in a grocery store, stay on the outside aisles. Anything on the inside is processed.
Yeah, those fiber-rich fruits and vegetables are the key to reducing added sugar. So the brownies in the book, for example, I've got a double chocolate brownie that is sweetened with sweet potato. And that makes it that brownie gluten-free as well, which is just another nice little benefit, but for some people who are looking to reduce gluten. But it adds this natural sweetness without added sugar. And it's still got some chocolate chips in there, but that brownie is less than half the added sugar of a boxed brownie mix. And it comes together in your food processor. So to talk about how easy these recipes are, if you'd like to roast sweet potato and then put it into the brownies and do it that way, that's 100% fine. But you can also use canned sweet potato. And so you put that canned sweet potato with some almond butter and all the rest of the ingredients into your food processor. That blends up in a couple minutes and then goes right into the 9x13 baking dish and into the oven. So it's very easy. I wanted to make all of these recipes accessible so that we weren't adding more work. We're making it easier for you to enjoy what you love in a healthier way.
And by the way, you include the all-important Sloppy Joe recipe. Childhood wouldn't be childhood without it in the United States. One of the things you do that I really like, it's kind of fun, is you compare ours and theirs in terms of how many teaspoons or fractions thereof of sugar are in each recipe. It's kind of fun to look and see how much you can change it. Like the pineapple teriyaki short ribs, you go from 6.5 teaspoons for theirs down to 3/4 teaspoon for yours. Who is there?
Yeah, so we tried to look at a series of products that you would use with a teriyaki glaze, right? A teriyaki glaze that you would typically use to make short ribs.
Like when you buy in a jar in the store?
Right,
okay.
Exactly. And those teriyaki glazes can show up with a lot of added sugar, a surprising amount of added sugar. And so we looked at several products to understand where that was trending towards. And then we lean towards the conservative estimate. So you're going to find teriyaki sauces that have more than that amount of added sugar in them. But we tried to be conservative. And then took that conservative number and remastered the recipe so there was at least 50% less added sugar. And then, like in this case, sometimes much less. So you're getting that extra benefit. And that sauce, those sauces are places where a surprising amount of added sugar shows up. Mm-hmm. I mean, in a hoisin sauce, for example, there can be 30 teaspoons of added sugar in the jar alone. Mm.
And just before I let you go, something that I thought was really cool that you did was delve into the idea of breakfast pops, that is frozen, you know, like popsicles, but with all kinds of good stuff in them that you can just give your kid to eat. I thought that was really cool. Is it something new? One is called Honey Peach Breakfast Pops. There was a huge difference in the number of sugar in it, but I also thought, once you make them, how convenient is that?
It is a convenient breakfast, and you know, all of us are busy. Parents are busy. Everybody's busy. So a quick grab-and-go breakfast like that is getting you some protein from the Greek yogurt and fiber from the chia seeds and some natural sweetness from the peaches. Like, that's just a great grab-and-go option, and it's a much healthier version of a typical froyo type of pop. And breakfast in general is just one of those places where you can make a big impact. If there's one simple thing that you can do is try and have a low-sugar breakfast to set yourself on the right path for the day. When you go back and talk about the ours versus theirs, a typical waffle with maple syrup has 16 teaspoons of added sugar. And I do a pumpkin spice waffle in the book that is obviously sweetened with pumpkin and a maple yogurt that goes with it. That takes the total down to 1.5 teaspoons. So it's really a fraction of added sugar. And that waffle is packed with fiber and delicious pumpkin to send you on your way for the day in a much healthier way.
I'm getting hungry, so that means it's a great cookbook. I've got it here in front of me, and it really is a nice cookbook. Jennifer Tyler Lee, thanks for joining me to talk about it. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Anne.
Jennifer Tyler Lee is a nutritionist and co-author of the new cookbook. It's called Half the Sugar and All the Love. Her co-author is Anisha Patel. She's a pediatrician out of Stanford University. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Thank you, Jennifer. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A new study in the JAMA Otolaryngology Head and Neck Surgery suggests people with obstructive sleep apnea are at a higher risk for mood disorders such as anxiety and depression. Sleep apnea also has been linked to a host of serious ailments, including heart disease and premature death. Another study suggests that the vast majority of African Americans with the disorder haven't been diagnosed or treated by a doctor. Dr. Jesse Mindell is a neurologist and sleep disorder specialist at the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Is it just sleep apnea, or is it obstructive sleep apnea, or is it all the same thing?
There's different types of sleep apnea. Probably 90% of patients have obstructive sleep apnea, which is associated with snoring and higher risk for predominantly cardiovascular disease. There are other types, but they're pretty infrequent.
Why does it happen? Why do people stop breathing?
With obstructive apnea, it's the result of a blockage in the upper airway, so typically behind the tongue or in the back of the throat somewhere. And it happens for a combination of reasons. Most people are predisposed to developing it because that part of their airway is smaller than it's supposed to be. And then on top of that, you add in things like being overweight or having cranial features or structures that put them at a higher risk. As people get older, it's related to a decrease in muscle tone when they're sleeping. So the muscles that are supposed to keep their airway open don't work as hard as they're supposed to.
We don't think of those muscles as something to work out, could you?
People have looked at that using breathing exercises, and you kind of get a mixed bag of results. Because when you exercise those muscles, they tend to get larger, which can constrict the airway even more. We do know that exercise in general increases your body's overall muscle tone, and that improves sleep apnea, even without weight loss or other things like that.
As I said, it's been linked to other kinds of conditions, but why the link to depression and anxiety, is it?
That's right. So it's a really interesting article because they followed patients for a long time, almost a decade, and they only looked at people that had never been diagnosed with any type of mood disorder, which includes anxiety, depression, bipolar disorder, as a group, and the risk was significantly higher. Now, when people think about sleep apnea, it's primarily concerned about cardiovascular disease because that's the major contributor to your long-term health. And we know that that's most related to the effect of low oxygen when people are sleeping during the periods when they're not breathing. But there's kind of a second half to the story, which is that sleep apnea causes an increase in inflammation in people's body. And other conditions that cause similar increases in inflammation are also associated with the higher risk to develop mood disorders. So it may be that it's along a different pathway.
And why? What do we know about the connection between sleep apnea and inflammation?
So sleep apnea causes an increase when people have measured them in animals and in humans in pro-inflammatory biomarkers. And so when we look at those things and follow patients over time, that's how they design these types of studies. There isn't a single one that anybody that would be like a target for treatment. We just think it's sort of a, you know, the effect of the body. And that's associated with other things like autoimmune diseases. People have looked at it, how it relates to cancer treatments and other types of things.
Hmm. Then there's also links to these other conditions. I hate to call them more serious ones because anxiety and depression are serious. But cardiovascular disease, asthma exacerbation, glaucoma, erectile dysfunction, and neurocognitive problems. Is that just because you're not getting enough sleep?
You're right. So there's the symptom side of sleep apnea, which is what, you know, patients complain of. Being tired, waking frequently at night, they affect their bed partner sleeping because of they move too much or they snore really loudly.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the medical side, which is sort of these associations with cardiovascular disease. And I mention that as being more serious primarily because if you look at the cause of mortality and long-term debilitation in the U.S., heart attacks, strokes, things like that are still by far the most common problems that we run into.
Women were in that first study that we talked about, women were with obstructive sleep apnea were more likely than men to develop a mood disorder. What do you make of that?
I don't know. That's not something that I've kind of come across before, so I can't comment on that.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about obstructive sleep apnea with Dr. Jesse Mindell, a sleep specialist at The Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. The other study that I mentioned looked at about 800 African-American adults in Mississippi, all of whom had undergone a home-based sleep study, and about one out of four were found to have apnea based on the sleep study results, but fewer than 5% of them had been diagnosed or treated for the condition. What's the significance of that?
So this is kind of the research article and then the article that came out in the press, you know, address very different things. The press article is really misleading. If you read the first line of the press article, it says that, you know, 25% of African Americans in the U.S. may have sleep apnea. But really, this study was done on a stacked deck, so to speak. So if you look at the study, it looks at, you know, 90% of these individuals were over 50, almost 80% had high blood pressure, more than half were obese. You're looking at a population that's very likely to have sleep apnea to begin with. So it's not really generalizable.
Okay.
The second part of the study was, like you had said, a very small percentage of patients had previously been evaluated for having sleep apnea in spite of the fact that 25% of them look like they have it. And there's probably a couple of reasons why that might be. Traditionally, patients would be screened if they reported that they were, you know, really tired and didn't have a good reason. And then if their, you know, primary doctor saw that they were overweight and snored or had other reasons to think they might have sleep apnea. More recently, there's been this idea of phenotypes with sleep apnea, meaning what are the symptoms that people get even though they have the same disease. And we found that there's a larger than expected proportion of people that have sleep apnea that don't have sleepiness. And so there's probably a lot of people that may have it, but that nobody would have suspected in the past. If you look at the Jackson study, so these are individuals that have those medical conditions that we've talked about, the heart disease and things like that, that are definitely related to untreated sleep apnea, but because they didn't have symptoms, probably weren't evaluated. It also could be related to the distribution of sleep centers across the country, and that may be a relatively underserved area. Sleep medicine in general is relatively underserved, and so not be providers available for those services.
Do you think that there's a racial profiling thing going on here? It's certainly been an issue in other studies, particularly African-American women being under undertreated or mistreated or misdiagnosed and that kind of a thing.
You know, it's certainly possible. What would might stand out to me more if there's a socioeconomic bias to it, more than anything else. And that may also be dominated by racial distribution in certain areas of the country. But there may be some inherent bias as well. I'm not sure. It's possible.
When, you know, are the treatment options for sleep apnea, I'm kind of interested in this idea that people can have sleep apnea but not be tired the next day. Why is it that some people it creates a symptom of sleepiness in some people and not in others?
So we don't know exactly. And so one theory on that is that the sleepiness is really a biomarker, and that people with sleep apnea who are more sleepy are actually more severe than other patients. The reasons why somebody might be sleepy are fairly clear-cut. If you look at people with sleep apnea, they have these frequent episodes where they stop breathing. And in order to breathe, they have to wake up. And it takes a significant amount of time to get into a deeper sleep. So with more severe sleep apnea, people spend a smaller percentage of their time in deeper sleep, which should be more restful than light sleep is. And their sleep in general becomes more disrupted. So we think we know why they're sleepy. We just don't know why some of them aren't. And that's probably the better question. It isn't clear if it's because some people are less susceptible to having their sleep disrupted to start with. We know that the amount of sleep that people actually need is highly variable person to person. So is it that the people who are sleepier are getting less sleep on average because of sleep apnea, or do they not need it? It isn't clear, but we do know that the patients with sleep apnea seem to have a higher risk to develop other health problems from it.
Katie in Columbus, you're on the air with Dr. Jesse Mindell from the Wexner Medical Center. Hi, Katie.
Hi. I just wanted to know if snoring was always a part of sleep apnea. I never snore, and sometimes I wake up gasping for air, and it's terrifying for a moment because I can't breathe. But I don't snore. My partner never hears me snore. And I've always read that that's a sign. So I just wanted to know if that was always the case. Thank you.
Okay, yeah, Katie, interesting question. For one thing, Dr. Mindell, is that waking up gasping for air a sign of apnea?
It's a very common one. It's not to say that if you don't wake up and gasp for air that you can't have it. If you do wake up gasping for air, yeah, it would. That would be a symptom that we would probably do testing for.
But she says she doesn't snore, so you don't want, snoring isn't the only sign.
That's right. I think it's about 40% of people that snore habitually will develop sleep apnea at some point in time. So 60% of people that snore aren't going to get it or don't have it at the time. almost everybody with obstructive sleep apnea does snore at nighttime when they're sleeping, but not everybody, especially if somebody's had an upper airway surgery, like had their tonsils and adenoids removed or something like that. They may not snore anymore, but they could still have collapsing in their airway. Like I said, obstructive sleep apnea is by far the most common kind, but you can stop breathing in your sleep for other reasons, so it could be something else altogether.
And you think Katie should get it checked out?
Yeah, I'd love to know. I mean, depending on, you know, other health health conditions she has, mm-hmm. symptoms she has, then certainly she should want to get tested. But the type of testing we do would depend more on what we're looking for, especially if somebody's on certain medications or things like that.
Yeah. What she described, waking up gasping for air or trying to breathe, sounds horrible. And but when I talk to people who have sleep apnea, a lot of times they say they didn't even realize they had it until they were tested for it.
That's right. So people can wake up, you know, feeling short of breath for a variety of different reasons. So sometimes it can be related to like asthma symptoms or something like that, or if somebody has other lung disease like COPD. Sometimes people can wake up gasping because of a nightmare uh-huh. or because of stress or things like that. So there are other things that can do it. You know, we mostly are going to test for something like sleep apnea because it's associated with these other health risks. And some of these other things may not be.
Well, Dr. Jesse Mindell, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Not a problem. Happy to be here.
Dr. Jesse Mindell is a sleep specialist at The Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Kim Balliol, who has type 1 diabetes, has written a book to help children understand the condition that affects roughly 1.25 million adults and children in the U.S. The book is titled Mommy Beeps. It's illustrated by Alessina Bonadio. And I welcome Kim Balliol to the show. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Kathleen Wine is an endocrinologist at Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center, where she specializes in treating patients with type 1 diabetes. Welcome to the show, Dr. Wine.
Thank you.
Dr. Wine, I wanted to start with you first. Could you give us a working definition of type 1 diabetes?
So type 1 diabetes is where you have an absolute deficiency of insulin. Your body does not make any insulin, and you need to take insulin to replace what your body's not making.
This is the kind of diabetes that you're sort of born with, or it's congenital, or it has nothing to do with lifestyle necessarily, or weight or anything like that.
Correct, but there's a misconception that it only happens in children.
Right.
And in fact, more than half of it is diagnosed in adults, meaning over the age of 18. And in the last year, I've diagnosed several people in their 70s with true autoimmune type 1 diabetes.
How does that happen? Where did the misconception come from in the first place?
Because in the past, we used to call them juvenile onset and adult onset. So it was just assumed that if you're over the age of 18 to 21, you must be type 2 diabetes.
And clinically, what's the difference, or are they treated exactly the same?
No, they're actually treated quite differently. As I said, with type 1 diabetes, we replace the insulin that your body's not making. Mm-hmm. And we do that either with insulin injections or using devices such as insulin pumps. Whereas someone with type 2 diabetes, initially what we try to do is use our pills to balance their relative insulin deficiency and the insulin resistance. So the pills decrease the insulin resistance and they augment your own natural ability to make insulin. Eventually, the pills can't balance it anymore and the person needs replacement insulin injections.
If it's discovered as an adult that someone has type 1 diabetes, is there something that had happened that triggered it or what?
You know, that would probably win you a big prize if you could figure out what triggers it.
All I do is ask the questions, Dr. White.
We don't know what triggers it, but actually only about a third of people with type 1 have someone in their family who has it, but there's clearly a genetic component to it. What we do know from a study called TrialNet, which is a natural history study where we screen first and second degree relatives, this study's been going on for about 20 years, funded by the NIH, and we've learned that the antibodies appear about 5 years before the diabetes does. So if you're screening family members, we may be able to give you a warning that it's coming. The problem is it's not common enough to screen the antibodies in the general population.
Kim Balliol, I wanted to turn to you. And first of all, when were you diagnosed with type 1 diabetes?
I was 12 years old. I went in for a cheerleading physical and we knew something was wrong, but you know, it turned out to be type 1.
And what do you mean you knew something was wrong?
I had all of the classic symptoms of type 1.
What are they?
Excessive thirst, frequent urination, a lot of weight loss, dry skin, just chronic fatigue. And turns out my blood sugar was about 846 when
Which
I was
means...
diagnosed. So a normal blood sugar is between 80 and 120. So it was significantly high.
Is it? Do you find, Dr. Wine, that with children and a 12-year-old, they're just not going to report? They're not. She went in for a cheerleading physical, but she'd already had all these symptoms. Do people tend to ignore these kind of things?
It's not that they ignore it, but they come on pretty precipitously usually. And at first, you try to use your common sense and say, "Oh, maybe my child's been sick, or maybe it's a change in the weather." Very commonly, the type 1 comes on after a viral illness like a gastroenteritis. So you don't realize as the person's getting better from the illness that they're still drinking a lot of water or they didn't regain the few pounds they lost during the illness.
And so, Kim Balliol, when you found out, what did you think? You're 12 years old. Yeah, you know, you're in that tween age, so you probably were kind of in your know-it-all phase.
Yeah.
But what did you think?
I didn't think much at the time. It was just all very overwhelming and trying to piece together. There's a bit of validation just because, you know, I would get up multiple times during my classes to go to the bathroom and teachers started to look suspiciously thinking that I was just trying to skip class when, in fact, I really was going to the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of a relief in a sense to know that it was something wrong and something that was manageable and treatable.
Is the urination issue a function, Dr. Wine, of the thirst issue?
No, actually, it's a function of the high sugar level. And so the high sugar level actually causes your kidneys to dump fluid as it tries to dump the sugar. And so then the urination causes the thirst. And then because you're having all these fluxes, it makes you tired. And the other thing, especially for a 12-year-old, is they're getting up at night multiple times to go urinate, and that makes them tired. And then they'll fall asleep in class, and then that causes even more problems.
Did you find that, Kim?
Yes.
It's interesting. I mean, I'm always fascinated by type 1 diabetes anyways, but we're talking about a book that Kim Balliol wrote and to help explain it to children who are around somebody who has type 1 diabetes. I want to talk to that. But first, I want to take a quick call from James in Westerville. James, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. So my question is for your experts. There was a Netflix special called What the Health, in which they kind of pushed the idea that a vegan diet or a plant-based diet would either stave off diabetes or reverse it completely. I was just wondering if that's something that could be either confirmed or debunked.
Dr. Wine?
So something like that is going to be more relevant to type 2 diabetes than type 1 diabetes. Type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune process, and we're still trying to understand the process so that we can figure out how to prevent it. But in the setting of type 2 diabetes, if you recall, I mentioned we use the pills to either improve insulin resistance or increase natural insulin secretion or both. So to some extent, you can do that with changes in diet and activity. Activity significantly improves insulin sensitivity. Changes in diet can also decrease how much insulin you need and how sensitive you are to insulin. We don't have anything that we could say cures it, but we can kind of put it into remission with some of those things.
Kim, you wrote this book for children. Tell us why you decided it was needed.
Because there wasn't another one like it. So there are a handful. There could be more, but there are a handful of resources out there for being type 1 and pregnant.
Like or boring little pamphlet type of things?
Pamphlets and a handful of books. There was a type 1 and pregnancy book that was really helpful for me when I was pregnant. But the amount of resources out there for kids who are exposed to a type 1 are pretty much nil. There's resources for kids who have type 1, but I didn't want that. I needed a slightly different perspective. And I'm a part of a mom's group for type 1 diabetes, moms with type 1, not of a type 1. Mm-hmm. And they're just kept... Every couple months, someone said, is there a book that's basically this book? And the answer was always no. And I just kind of kept seeing that. And after a few experiences of my own, I decided to get it out there as a resource.
I guess, Dr. Wine, I was kind of surprised that there wasn't a book out there already. I mean, my God, there's millions of books for kids nowadays. What did you think, Dr. Wine, of the idea?
So I thought it was fantastic, and I really enjoyed taking a look at it. Mm-hmm. The reason I think it's really, really important is we forget to talk to our patients about their families. And we especially forget to talk to them about their children, to ask them, how are your children doing with you have diabetes? Have you talked to them about it? Are they scared that you're going to go low, but they don't know how to tell you? And so often when we do talk to the children as adults, they say, you know, I spent all my teen years being so scared something would happen to my mom. And this is a fantastic way to get that out there, to open that dialogue and give the child a chance to talk about it and express their concerns and give the child a chance to try to understand.
I was surprised it was self-published, Kim Balliol. It's a really nice book, but I was surprised. Did you try to get it published?
I did not.
Okay, you just went ahead and self-published.
I just went ahead and did it, yeah.
Okay.
When I started and came up with the idea, I don't have a background in children's writing. I work for the City of Columbus Department of Public Service, so farthest from kids' book that you can get. And so I did the research. I joined a local children's author book and started to look into how to go about doing this. And when I saw just the potential letters of rejection and just the effort, I had to balance it with my own time and knew that I didn't have the resources to push for it to be gone through a traditional publisher.
And you wanted to get this out.
I just wanted to get it out. So when I found out there was the self-publish option, I went that way.
And you found an illustrator, too.
I did. I found her on a global freelancing site. And honestly, I wasn't expecting anyone to take the project on. I put it up there and basically said this is a passion project, and I ended up getting over 30 responses in 12 hours of people interested in illustrating it. When I found Elisana, her work just spoke to me. It was phenomenal, and yeah. I knew right away that she was the right choice for this.
You said you did research for the book. What kind of research went into this?
How to write a children's book.
Okay.
How the language should be structured. You know, my original draft, there's way more drafts than you would think with a children's book and rewriting.
Uh-huh.
And the original draft was from the perspective of the mother. And it didn't take me long in reading how to write a children's book that's not going to fly. It needs to be from the perspective of the child.
And I'm wondering, did it help that you were kind of 12 years old, so that's not like a young child, which mm-hmm. is what you're gearing this toward.
Yes.
But did it help that you were younger when you were diagnosed with type 1?
It did. I wouldn't say it played too much. I honestly think my experiences with my own children played more into it. But the personal experience of being diabetic myself is more in the mom side throughout mm-hmm. the whole thing.
Yeah, it kind of makes you wonder what other books could be written out there, doesn't it, Dr. Wine?
Oh, absolutely. And I agree with you. That's something I was thinking, too, is how else could we go at this and teach children about it?
Yeah. So how have your kids responded to it?
Well, I have two little boys. My older son, there's the page where she's checking her blood sugar. He always freaks out and runs down the hallway, but then he comes back for the rest of it. My younger son absolutely loves it. So
what do you mean check your blood?
Yeah. So sugar part level. Of type 1 diabetes is checking your blood glucose every day. And you
is
do
that
so
that
with a finger stick
on your arm?
Oh, the one on my arm is actually my insulin pump.
Oh, OK.
So and the diabetic in the book is modeled after the same pump I'm on. But there are many different treatment options, which was a challenge in writing this because there are so many ways to treat type 1 diabetes that I wanted to be as inclusive as possible.
It's called Mommy Beeps, the title of the book.
Yes.
Why that?
Because I beep. The insulin pump will beep when it is finished. And if someone has a different type of pump, some of those beep. And blood sugar, blood glucose monitors also tend to beep. So there tends to be a lot of beeping and buzzing when you're a type 1 diabetic.
Do very many people, Dr. Wine, still inject themselves?
Yes, probably only about a third to half of people use insulin pumps. Part of that is personal preference, and the other part has been challenges with insurance coverage of the devices.
What was your experience as far as getting a pump?
Well, actually, my experience is a little bit special. In terms of getting approved for it, it was a little strange because I actually had to I had okay control when I was originally going after a pump, and it had to be a little bit worse for insurance to approve it. So I actually had to kind of run a little bit higher for a month, which is not okay.
No.
But, you know, it was long enough to get that approval. And then once I got it, it was essentially a lifetime prescription. So I don't really have to worry about the approval now that I have it.
Huh.
My Dexcom, which is a continuous glucose monitor. So that's a great device that reads my blood sugar every 5 minutes. That one I was able to get when I wanted to try for pregnancy. And that reason was enough to get insurance to approve it.
Why is type 1 diabetes associated with the high-risk pregnancy, Dr. Wine?
Because it is high risk. No, one of the things we know about pregnancy is any kind of diabetes makes you high risk, whether it's type 1 or type 2. And if your sugars are elevated, then they're a risk to the babies, starting with congenital birth defects, but also risk as you go through the pregnancy, and including risk of preeclampsia, preterm labor, having a big baby, so it's dangerous during the delivery. And so we really work hard with both type 1 diabetes and type 2 diabetes for intensive glucose control during that time period. If I could, I want to just mention what she said about having to have bad control to get the pump.
Mm-hmm.
That used to be the case in the past, but that is not the case anymore. And really,
that's
the only criteria to get someone an insulin pump is that the person wants the pump. Where I trained, it was very dictatorial. If the big boss didn't think you were a good candidate, you weren't allowed. But I don't believe in that at all. Like I said, the first step is if you want the pump. If you want the pump, then we'll work with you and find a way for you to get it. And the insurance companies no longer require proof of high A1C or severe lows or anything. It's just a matter of proof of having type 1.
Is there any evidence, Dr. Wine, that having the pump, either the monitor, automatic monitor or the automatic pump, is good? It's better treatment. It's a better thing, or is it very individualistic?
There's actually quite a bit of evidence. When you look at the pump, the initial studies showed that they decreased hypoglycemia but did not improve A1C, and that was for scientific reasons. But there's a long-term study from, I believe, Sweden showing that people who were treated with insulin pumps had less long-term cardiovascular disease. When you look at the continuous glucose monitor, even the first randomized controlled study showed that you decreased hypoglycemia and decreased A1C, thereby decreasing your risk of complications such as eye, nerve damage, kidney damage, and so on. So the obvious thing is to combine both of them together to get your maximal effect on decreasing hypoglycemia and improving A1C, and in fact, that's what happened.
Kim, how's the book selling?
really well. I've been humbled by the response, to be honest.
Well, we'll have a link to the book on our website at WOSU.org/allsides for anybody out there that's interested in checking it out. Kim Balliol, thank you for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Kim Balliol, she's author of Mommy Beeps, a book for children who love a type 1 diabetic. And Dr. Kathleen Wine, endocrinologist at Ohio State's Wexner Medical Center. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you for letting me join you.
That's it for Wellness Wednesday. Thank you so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.